Thank you. Good evening. My name is Stephen Weller. I'm Pro Vice Chancellor of Students at Victoria University. And tonight I'm chairing the seminar in my role as President of ATEM, the Association for Tertiary Education Management. On behalf of the Centre for the Study for Higher Education and Management and the L.H. Martin Institute for Higher Education Leadership and Management, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the third of the 2009 Tertiary Education Policy Seminars. In a post-Bradley context, perhaps midway through the first wave of an education revolution, and hopefully at the end of a global financial crisis, it's perhaps timely to consider the start of a new era. So far in the seminar series, we've heard on what the 2009 federal budget meant for tertiary education, and what were the cross-sectoral implications of the Bradley targets for participation and equity. But tonight we're exploring quality, standards and regulation, and the role of the new agency, the Tertiary Education Quality and Standards Agency, or TEQSA, unless somebody wants to give me a different way of pronouncing it. So TEQSA, according to the DUA fact sheet, a couple of quotes that I've put in through here. According to the DUA fact sheet, the current regulatory environment is complex and fractured, and TEQSA will balance the move to a more sustainable student-centred funding model, ensuring that increased participation will be accompanied by improvements in the quality of university teaching and learning. At the same time, the Australian Higher Education Supplement reported that there were doubts that clouded the role of TEQSA, doubts before it had begun, and that the new super regulator has been given a bigger, more politically sensitive task than expected and probably doesn't have the money to do the job properly anyhow. Into this already challenged environment, ORCWA recently released a discussion paper on academic standards so as to permit clear, meaningful and comparable reporting on the level of achievement of students and graduates. Yet Campus Review last week reported the comments on one submission which described this attempt to develop a framework for academic standards as laudable but difficult to deliver a meaningful response to a sensible demand. And if the new era was not already challenging enough, there's the ongoing debate over the Australian education and training environment for international students. Adele Horan in the Sydney Morning Herald on this weekend wrote, and I'll quote this one, I think it was quite a good quote, "You do not need to be a Marxist to know that the free market in training international students would end in tears. Now that blood is on the floor, families are ruined, and Australia's third biggest export industry, education, is in serious jeopardy, everyone says they saw it coming." At the same time, Professor Gardner of RMIT defended the quality of the Australian university sector, indicating that the crisis hadn't been created by the university sector or its funding. Rather, the regulators had failed to maintain sufficient oversight of the ballooning private vocational sector, which itself was the result of a government allowing migration to be too closely linked to education. So let it not be said that the start of a new era is not without challenge. However, thankfully this evening, we have two eminent speakers who can share their perspective on quality standards and regulation and the start of a new era. Professor Alan Robson, AM, is Vice-Chancellor of the University of Western Australia and current Chair of the Group of Eight Universities. He was also recently named 2009 Western Australian Citizen of the Year. Professor Robson has made a significant contribution to national policy in the areas of research, quality and equity. He's also flown in this morning from Queensland and flies out to Western Australia tomorrow morning, probably still our time in the evening. Dr. Hamish Coates is a Principal Research Fellow at ASA, the Australian Council for Education Research, where he's leading an influential research program on the measurement and the evaluation of higher education processes, contexts and outcomes. He's travelled from the eastern suburbs, so you can be more brutal. Both of our speakers will make their presentations sequentially. There's an opportunity for half an hour for questions at the end of that. At that time, I'll ask you to identify yourself and where you're from. But for the moment, can I ask you to join both of our presenters and welcome them this evening. Professor Robson.
Thanks very much. It's a great pleasure. This is the university that I graduated from 44 years ago, so I'm very pleased to have this chance to talk this evening. I've titled my talk, Quality Standards and Regulation, Are We There Yet? I refuse to use the term a new era because that implies that we haven't been doing anything and that we're going to be starting from scratch. What I'd like to argue is that Australia has a quality system. It is extensive and rigorous. It's not perfect. It needs improving, but we're not starting from scratch. So it's extensive and rigorous. If you look at performance reporting, that's required under the Commonwealth funding agreements. We have performance funding, which is very significant, both in the Australian Teaching and Learning Performance Fund, but also in the research quantum, where our performance dictates how much funding we receive from what was the IGS, the RIBG and the RTS. Now, I'm a great believer in performance reporting. I'm a great believer in evidence-based decision-making. I also think that we also need to confront the brutal facts. So I think that this is very important. We also have national protocols. And of course, we have an institutional assessment framework. And someone once described to me the COMPACS as the institutional assessment framework on steroids. In other words, we're going to start with that and then we're going to look forward from what that process has been and with a view to developing institution-specific targets. Now, I want to say something about equity and access targets because this is going to be part of the new system. Now, I believe the current proposal is that we get a fixed amount per low SES student. I don't think this is a very smart idea because I think two problems with it. Firstly, it costs a lot more to develop Indigenous doctors and lawyers than to train people in Indigenous studies. And if we're going to address the issues, we're going to need to be training Indigenous doctors and lawyers, which is what my university thinks is its main role with Indigenous students. And secondly, we ought to be concerned about enrolments. We ought to be concerned with completions, not enrolments. And it then raises the very interesting question that every university has a role in improving access, but is it the same role in all institutions? But coming back to the main theme, the existing system is extensive and rigorous. We have ORCA audits, and they're going to be replaced by TESQA. We have accreditation by independent professional bodies, both domestic and international. We have state government regulation and reporting. In Western Australia, our performance indicators are audited by the Auditor General. We have a research assessment exercise that is being developed called ERA, the Excellence for Research Australia. And within institutions, we have a tool called Socrates, which enables me to look at the performance of every academic within the University of Western Australia in terms of their performance in relation to research and research training. And of course, our whole research system is based on peer review, which is about ensuring research quality. So our grants are peer reviewed and our publications are peer reviewed, so that there's a lot of scrutiny in the system. And it goes on. We have the recognition of units by other universities, international and domestic. We have the CRICUS international student requirements. We have student feedback through CEQ, Course Experience Questionnaire, and Graduate Destination Survey. We have student surveys that are internal to our institutions, which are looked at very carefully by ORCA, things that we call the student perception of teaching. And then finally, we have assessment of theses and capstone projects by external assessors, by external examiners. So there's a lot of scrutiny going on in the system, and it's not such that the system is not undergoing scrutiny. We have internal faculty departmental and divisional reviews with external reviewers. We have international ranking systems, and we mightn't like them, but they're a fact of life. And we have the importance of reputation, that the individual reputations of institutions are built up over long periods of time. It includes community engagement. So reputation is an important means of assuring quality. It goes a long way to a whole of university approach to quality and standards. So I would argue that the existing system has delivered a comprehensive, high-quality university system. Universities aspiring to quality and excellence in research, innovation, student learning, teaching, community and industry engagement, universities actively pursuing their different missions, strong demand for university places, including strong demand from international students who don't have to choose to come and study in Australia, could choose to go and study anywhere in the world, but they do choose to come and study in Australia, high levels of graduate employment, and strong demand from government and industry for university research. So I'm arguing that we've got a lot of quality assurance within the Australian university system, and we have a high quality university system. So if we go further there, what has the system delivered? Well, an international reputation of having a strong university system in research, teaching and learning, and international education. And we perform above our weight in terms of these international rankings. 17 of the 38 universities are in the top 500 on the Shanghai Jiaotong ranking of research universities, and 12 Australian universities are in the very shonky Times Higher Education supplement rankings. We do miles better there than what we should, because we have a lot more international students than our competitors, and they give that a high rating. So there are a lot of things that have been delivered by the system. Is the system perfect? No. It doesn't generate quantifiable results. It needs to be more effective and efficient. It's not clear to people outside the higher education system, nor to all within it. And there's low public awareness of the quality system. Now, we were recently audited. We got a wonderful audit, very positive, and no one has written it up at all, because there wasn't too many critical things to say about us. So now, they're all the positives, but today I was at Universities Australia, and Bruce Baird, who's conducting the ESOS review, a similar account was given to him, and he said, what about the university that you're not naming, the one that you haven't been able to, that is not delivering appropriately? And that is an issue for the sector. If the sector wants to be self-regulating, we can't afford to have rogue universities performing in a way that brings the whole system, the whole university system, into disrepute. See, I don't think that most of the discussion around international students and deficiency is a problem with the university system. It's primarily a problem with the private providers in the VET system. And it's a problem because of a lack of enforcement of regulations, largely by state governments, which has led to a very deplorable situation, which has then led to great concerns overseas about the whole of the Australian tertiary education system. So by having a university that's not performing according to the rules, and our system has not been able to address that deficiency, We have a problem that we need to address. So where are we? A quality system exists in Australia. The mechanisms of quality assurance and monitoring are extensive and comprehensive, but the mechanisms of the quality system need improvement. Now, the ORCA put out, as our chair has outlined, a paper called Setting and Monitoring Academic Standards for Higher Education. And on their website, on the ORCA website, you can see the criticisms of that approach that have come from the sector primarily. Firstly, it risks the diversity of the sector. Secondly, it stifles ability to have variations and innovations in student learning. Thirdly, interdisciplinary standards will require a very expensive system of calibration, comparability, and monitoring. And it may require national testing to yield usable data, and there's a very high administrative burden. Now, in our university system, there's a very wide variation in entry standards amongst universities. And we pretend many times that there's no difference in exit standards, but we don't really know. And that is an issue that is in this current debate. But does it matter? What is in the key interest of the community is really about minimum standards, that all graduates pass minimum standards. Now, standards, the current debate says standards need constant reworking or risk being limiting or out of date. Unless set at a minima, standards can be limiting. So, and Robin McTaggart said in Campus Review, standards cannot be designed to anticipate future excellence. And knowledge is international. Standards based on national frame of reference diminish international linkages. So I'm arguing that this is a very limiting approach. Exit testing, if we have to teach to an exit test, this will lead to informing the content of the courses. It'll lead to standardisation of curriculum across universities, and it'll potentially reduce diversity. It ignores the wider university experience of students. I tell students at my university, if they leave with just a degree, they've missed out, because our university is a school leaver university, so students coming into that university have to leave with a wide circle of friends, a whole lot of networks. They've got to have developed interpersonal skills. They've got to have a whole lot of generic skills that can be tested by an exit test, but sometimes is not. And it will ignore the diversity in learning environments. So what can we learn by looking at what happens elsewhere? Well, the United Kingdom have spent millions of pounds on trying to address this problem. 10 years developing subject benchmarks that are highly variable and may have weakened quality. And you have the National Union of Students demanding external examiner reports be published widely. And you have a system of external examiners as a means of maintaining nationally comparable standards. And a recent article in the Times Higher Education Supplement says that it's thought not to be working. I'll come back to that in a minute. So if we go to Denmark universities get funded on the number of graduates they produce, not on the number of people they enrol. So they have to have an external examiner system. And the external examiners mark 1/3 of all student assessment, which is a very high level, but obviously in a system where you're rewarding people for graduating rather than enrolling, you will need to have such a system. And it's estimated in Denmark that 3% of university budgets goes to external examination. However, I believe that light-touch external examiners is a method that we should be looking at in Australia. I propose a system where you have external examiners accredited by the quality agency, TQSA. Universities choose the examiners from the list. You only do external examination of final year units. You do it once every 3 years, and the results have got to be available for the quality audit when the quality audit comes around. Now, that, to me, is an example of a system that would work. It's not terribly intrusive, and it would guarantee, I believe, minimum standards. So what's some other ways forward? Well, individual institutions have to be responsible for developing and evaluating academic programs that reflect scholarly values, so reflects their values, cultures and mission. A wide diversity of educational inputs, methods and level of performance is both desirable and necessary. And choosing not to pursue national academic standards does not mean that academic standards are being abandoned. Now, this is from the GO8 view. If we go further, the role of government is to ensure educational qualifications reach a minimum threshold standard. The role of universities is to demonstrate how well their graduates perform and exceed their minimum standards. The basic principles must be: benefits must exceed the cost and the administrative burden. The approach must be conceptually sound. The system must be workable. The system must enable and reflect diversity. And universities must remain autonomous. We must avoid standardisation of the sector, standard external testing, quality assurance or standards regime informing funding decisions across all facets of university activity. And in finishing, I'd like to draw your attention to a wonderful conference we're holding in Perth. It's called In the Zone. 60% of the economic activity of the world is in the same time zone of Perth, not the time zone of Melbourne. And this is a conference we're holding with a wide range of speakers. The reason why we're holding it is because we came over to the Melbourne Institute's Economic and Social Prosperity meeting. Western Australia got three mentions. In the whole of the 3 days of the meeting. Firstly, Western Australia was then distorting the economy by having a minerals boom. Secondly, wines served were from Margaret River. And thirdly, I was invited to speak because I was chair of the Group of Eight. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Alan, and I agree with everything that Alan has said. I'm going to, I guess, just carry on from perhaps some of the things that he said and maybe take us a little further in thinking about how this new idea, not starting from scratch, can be shaped up. First of all, just a word, I'm from ACR. We're an independent, not-for-profit research organisation. I'm going to start with three broad case studies and then I'm going to give some context and then I think maybe sketch a few ideas as to how we might think about how some of these new words that have been mentioned like standards might be given flesh going forwards. Can I just start by saying how many people here are from the university sector broadly? Who works at a university? And who works at a private higher education organisation? And how about the broadly conceived the training system? Okay, and a non-university type, be it government or myself, or yep, okay. I guess my presentation embraces a bit of all of those things. It's not specifically focused on universities, but primarily it will be going forwards. The first case study is just to imagine a university that involves these kinds of activities. They identify the things that count. They set externally referenced points of reference. They collect data, quantitative data, that they can use to prove that they're meeting those. They use the data to highlight areas of strength and identify those areas that they should be improving upon. They provide information to potential students on what they should be doing, and they can assure, as Alan was saying, the public that minimum standards are being set. That's my first little case study that I want you to hold in mind. I think if we can achieve that, we've achieved all that we need to in this whole debate. The second one is an experiment that I came up with at first year, which, as like Alan, I did undergraduate studies here, is that if you got the same paper and duplicated it, forgetting considerations to do with plagiarism here, but not a bad experiment to run in a university. I wonder how the results would play out. If we gave that paper to two different markers in different faculties, in different courses, in different universities, in the same field, in different countries, and in fact what I'm just referring to here is the external examiner system that Alan was talking about, what would we do if we got different results for exactly the same paper? In fact, one of these results will give you a fully funded scholarship to Oxford. The other one won't get you an APA here in Australia. So, you know, there's an issue of fairness to do with individual outcomes here that I think needs to be taken very seriously. I'm sure that this is the case in this university and every university across the world. And it's something that I think we do need to address, the quality of student assessment outcomes. And perhaps the most esoteric case study, these are little normal distributions, right? The distribution of marks at different universities. So over on the right here, we have a university that has a very disparate student body, whereas we have this very elite institution up the top, perhaps a medical faculty, okay? We have our performance up the side here. What we're talking about in this debate is setting minimum standards, and I completely endorse what Alan just said. We're not talking, and this is a very important point, and one which I think gets hidden because standards and standardisation are the same word, at least in English. I'm not sure about other languages. We're not talking about moving everyone to the same standard. I think that would be a very silly thing to seek to do, and it would lead to performance amount around the minimum standards. Just hold those case studies in mind, a bit of context for us. We're here, I guess, because we have a new regulatory and funding policy that's been proposed and the implementation is being thought through at this time. It's a very big industry, I guess, and when we look at other big industries and how they're regulated, it's important to think beyond the university system as to how that takes shape. There's certainly been a lot of unclarity in the university system. It's been, two or three years now. There was a review. Now we're thinking about how to implement those reviews. There's not been a lot of change. There's an interest in what will change, I suppose, and indeed what will stay the same. There's a recognition, I think, that the collegial approaches that used to work even back in the 1980s, when Australian higher education was a very different thing, are no longer sufficient to support this very large business. And I think that's something that might have led us to be here today. And also recognition that more sophisticated approaches are available and are feasible. And I work in an organisation that has a lot of people that work in the school system. I work in higher education, a bit in vocational education, and I can see the difference in the sophistication of the methodologies that are used in those areas. And I think universities could benefit from adopting some of them from their cousins in the school system. What's going on globally? We've got these rankings things. They're methodologically flawed, okay? The best one, the Chinese one, was dreamt up as a scholarly exercise, and it, because there was nothing else in that space, it's taken off. It's not really what we would base a quality assessment of higher education systems on. As I say, I'll refer to the school systems again. We have this thing called PISA. It's been going for about 10 years now. We're the international agency that coordinates it here from Camberwell. When you compare that to these rankings, it's no contest. There's all sorts of other things. There's a sort of project called a HELO that's gradually taking shape that's going to look at assessing students' outcomes from higher education. There's industry standards that have come to bear. Within Australia, there's this new idea of compacts that's taking shape, as Alan mentioned. There's this thing called the Australian Quality Training Framework, which is used in the vocational sector, which has a lot of conceptual and practical parallels but doesn't touch many of the conversations within higher education. It's important to think about those links. Of course, we have this thing called NAPLAN in the school sector, which tests every 3, 5, 7, and I think 9-year-old child in this country. And that's an important way that we think about regulating education in Australia. And how does higher education fit in with that? And of course, within institutions, Alan's given a very rich picture of exactly what happens in that kind of area. I'm not going to go on, but that's where most of it happens, at least within universities. I'm going to turn now to sketch what I think is needed to take the conversation forward to underpin what will happen in terms of the assessment of standards. I think we've got much of it in place. I think there's a room for maybe just tightening up what we do and a few additions in terms of adding new data, and in particular the kind of data that Alan mentioned around student assessment. The sort of principles that this system will need to have are really complex. This is not a trivial exercise. It's something that, for example, will need to stimulate diversity, but at the same time assure the public that minimum performance standards are being met. It needs to be learner-focused, conceptually sound. Okay, satisfying all of these principles is not going to be easy. It's not going to be quick, but it needs to be done if the system is actually to have the desirable policy, but more important, educational, professional and moral contribution to Australian society. More importantly, it needs to inspire excellence. We certainly want to encourage performance above the minimum standard and look very seriously at it when it falls below that standard. But I think we want to go a bit above that in terms of inspiring excellence. And the first part of that involves thinking, what on earth does this word standards mean? And that's messy business, okay? It's messy like this. This is one definition that someone submitted in a paper that went to the ALCO conference in the middle of the year. And I did take first year linguistics, and I can kind of make some sense of this. I think it's what happens when I'm in a foreign country and I try and there's a lot of pointing going on, a lot of gesture, but not much communication. We're not much beyond that in terms of defining standards in this country. And one of the interesting processes from the ALCO paper, which I had a role in thinking through, was it simply got the conversation going about how we define this very complex and contested term. Here's how I'm going to define it. There's two different ways we can think of the what of standards. So what are the indicators for high quality teaching? That's a what. Yeah? Good quality learning outcomes. Or we can think of the how much. And that's in fact exactly what a standard is. So my definition is that standards are levels of performance on indicators of quality, which means that we have to define our indicators and then we have to actually set performance measures along those indicators. The trouble is that in Australian higher education, we haven't done this since 1989. I can't think back. I was actually still in school the last time a national performance indicator system was defined in Australian higher education. The system has grown quite radically since then, internationalisation, all the rest. I think it's time that we actually thought through what are the indicators that we should use to reflect the what really counts in Australian higher education, because, of course, indicators do drive behaviour, particularly if they have funding attached. We need to think about how we can frame these indicators in a meaningful sense, and the OECD has done that in a very useful fashion. It's called the Innes Framework. More on that in a few slides. I think it's imperative that we shift towards looking at students and their learning. And that's, of course, very messy business in higher education. It's often secret academics business, but I think increasingly it's public business as well. And in terms of assuring that minimum standards have been met, we need to do that. And we need to do it in a way that is non-trivial, responsive, can be audited, efficient, all the rest of it. There's a whole series of criteria, and there's quite a methodology that's been developed around forming these kinds of indicators. In about late 2006, I got a call from the Australian Technology Network universities, and they asked me to define an academic standards model for the ATN. And this is what I came up with in terms of a series of indicators. A lot of indicators. Universities are very multifaceted and complex things. That sort of flowed on throughout 2007, and I believe there's now been some implementation of that, and it's been used to inform the reporting that's happened as part of their ALCO audits. These are the areas that I think it's really important to focus on, as I've said a few times already. We need to start focusing on what the learner's doing. I agree with reputation as being an important proxy for what the university has done to contribute to the community, and this event tonight is a good example of that. But focusing on what really counts, what the student is doing, who the student is, and what they're achieving is really, really, and of course teaching quality, is really, really important in terms of conversations about educational standards. Shortly after the ATN work, I got involved with Peter in developing some indicators for the vocational sector. And through the last 2.5, 3 years, there's been 3 indicators that have been developed, which are now used as the basis for quality assurance for 4,800 vocational providers in the country. This is them. So employer satisfaction, learner engagement, and then whether people are completing or not. And then, of course, we break them down into slightly more refined concepts. Those indicators, we felt, through extensive consultation, focused the mind of almost everyone in the vocational system on what really counts. Is a learner engaging and developing a good competency, competence in their area of expertise? And is the employer, who may be directly or indirectly subsidising the training, satisfied with that training? Being a bit more parsimonious, this is probably the set of indicators that I think should be taken forwards in Australian higher education. Have we got students who are accessing the system who should be? You know, not just the equity agenda. There's a whole range of other groups there that should be considered in terms of access. Have they got the aptitude to succeed? If a student doesn't have the aptitude to succeed, you're setting them up for failure. Have they got the aspirations? Are students, particularly for those from first and family, sufficiently aspiring to attend university? Are they engaging once they get there? If they're never showing up on campus, if they're not doing their homework, then they're probably not doing as well as they could. They're not, as Alan referred to, developing a broader life of the mind that they should be doing through their university experience. And, of course, is the teaching of high quality. But what we know is that student support, professional support, and also that administrative function of universities is really crucial for actually keeping a student enrolled. It's not just teaching quality. It's the outside the classroom stuff that counts as well. So we need to look at that. Are they achieving academically? And do they have all sorts of good outcomes? And I'll look at what some of these outcomes might be. So are we getting them there? Are we engaging them? And are we generating a capable professional at the end of the day? And, of course, these conversations need to link with the conversations that are going on in early childhood, the conversations that are going on in schools, the conversations that are going on in industry and the trades, and the conversations in the general community. It's not an isolated activity. To underpin these indicators, we need more data. There's currently 3 national points of reference in terms of the data collections available in Australian higher education, even less in the private higher education space. I'm not saying all data should be public, but even within institutions, there's a need for more data. It's going to be a large and diverse collection of data. Some of it will be national in nature. Some of it will pertain to certain disciplines. Some of it will pertain to certain institutions. But what I'm proposing is that this data must meet certain validity standards. It needs to be very important that you can have confidence that this data can be used for the purposes of quality assurance. Once we have that data, we need to set, as I said at the start, performance standards. I have a real beef with the word appropriate, because a lot of quality assurance standard setting in higher education currently is based on the word appropriate. And my appropriate isn't necessarily your appropriate. Appropriate is one way of setting a standard. It's by no means the most technically sophisticated, and it's by no means the way that's going to ensure that we have an efficient and robust system in place. We have all of these other approaches for setting standards, which I'm not going to bore you with, but they, in large part, are used, and they need to be used more and recognised as a way of setting standards. Once we've got our indicator and set our standard, then we're ready to start collecting data. Okay? Until we've done that, it doesn't make much sense to collect data. Luckily, the most important data source is already with us. Okay? It's student assessment data. So we need to look at ways in which we can generate assessments that lead to valid data that can be used to determine if on those indicators we've identified whether people are meeting certain standards. That's critical. There's a whole range of data sources, and I'm not going to talk through them in any detail, but I will go through some as a background. But what I am going to suggest is that these need to meet certain criteria. And while we didn't discuss our presentations beforehand, I can see that a lot of these align with the criteria that Alan talked through. They need to be registered and endorsed. They must be able to provide an assurance that minimum standards have been met. They need to be standards referenced, that means, and they need to be auditable. They need to be endorsed by the institution and meet certain technical and practical criteria. There may be other criteria. We currently don't meet these criteria in all of our assessment practices in Australian universities. I'm going to go through a few assessments that we have developed with universities on behalf of the government or on behalf of universities over the last few years at ACER. And one of them is this aptitude test called UniTest, which is currently being trialled as part of a national pilot program called the Student Aptitude Test for Tertiary Admission, SATA. What we're doing is we're seeing if an aptitude test will be a useful complement to achievement data for getting students into university, particularly those who have come from environments where the achievement data might not be as good as it should be in terms of reflecting their capacity to function as an excellent professional after 3 years of training. We've also got a test called STAT, very widely used with mature age applicants or applicants who aren't school leavers. Over the last 3 years, we've developed an assessment, there's now 35 universities taking part in it this year, called the Australasian Survey of Student Engagement. It's based on a collection that's run with 1,200 universities in the US. It's got the main collection with currently enrolled students, Aussie. There's a staff survey, the Staff Survey of Student Engagement, and we're currently piloting a postgraduate survey of student engagement. What it does give us is data that can be benchmarked internationally. So there's 1,200 universities in the US. There's also universities in Canada, and I know Allen's University has been pretty much the front runner in running this. I mean, I think UWA ran this 5 years or so ago and has been benchmarking with universities internationally using this for some time. There's also a collection being developed in South Africa called SASE, it's just starting, and Japan as well is doing this. For such an internationalised business, there's been such a paucity of valid data that universities could use to actually look at what they're doing and achieving. What we have seen, and this is data from last year, is that Australasian universities, I should say, simply aren't doing as well as some of their US counterparts. Here are the five dimensions that we measure in the survey, and you can see first and later year scores for the US and for Australasia. We're in the orange, they're in the blue. I'm not going to pause on this for long, but you can see there that there's room for improvement. And these aren't culturally specific things. These are things like, did you go into a library in the current academic year? What we can also see is that there's a rough educational rule of thumb that says a student should be spending 2 times out of class what they are in class. Now, of course, that's going to vary by year level and discipline, etc. Interestingly, there was a parliamentary inquiry into academic standards in the UK who just released their report earlier this year, I think, in fact, just a month ago, on higher education broadly, and academic standards was one of them. And they asked a very pointed question, are US students spending enough time studying? And what we can see here is there's only 23.5% of our students who are spending twice, that's the ratio of preparation to class time on the bottom there, twice what they are outside of class preparing than they are in class learning. Now, of course, it's a very broad brush metric, but it's not unless we have that data that we can actually start to say, well, there's room for improvement there, but actually maybe 2 is a bit high. Without the data, we can't start having an informed conversation. A few years ago, colleagues at the Centre for the Study of Higher Education here did some work on the characteristics of good assessment in higher education, and it's imperative, I think, that that kind of work is repeated. I really think that the future in terms of understanding standards is not just looking at do they have the capacity to succeed and are they engaging, but are they achieving? And that's an area where there's been almost no data, even at the university level, hitherto. And that sort of work, I think, needs to take further shape. We have now international databases, this one for medical education. Every university in Australia that has a medical program, as far as I can ascertain, dips into this database, which is maintained in Hong Kong, and gets assessment items out of it. So for professions like medicine, it's entirely possible that they can start to develop assessments that don't just come out of the filing cabinet from last year, but are actually validated and meet some kind of international criterion. Similar sort of proposition to the examination system that Alan was proposing. Here we're actually doing it with the script, not just after the event. And I should say this is not quite ideal because there's no quality assurance on the items in this particular collection. They're just loaded up by interested academics. We've got more and more sophisticated ways of developing student understanding of student capability. So here's a, I think it's the Pebble system. If there's anyone from RMIT here, you can correct me. But the student develops as they travel through their course a professional portfolio, which testifies at the end of it to the their learning experience and also what they've achieved, and you can look at their growth through their time at university. Very important, I think, very authentic way of measuring a student's learning. How do we get data out of that that can assure the community that things are happening well? In the US, the Association of American Colleges and Universities have developed these things called meta-rubrics. Okay, so what we do is we have the levels of performance down the side, the areas of performance down the side, what I was before calling our indicators, and then along the top we have thresholds. And simply, these are used very simply by groups of faculty, academic staff, maybe departments, centres, to sit around and map their curricula against this. It doesn't give you the data, but it does focus the mind on students and their learning, which is in itself most of the way to solving the problem. A few years ago, in fact last year, we ran something called the Graduate Pathway Survey with every university in the country. It's a study of graduates 5 years after graduation. So we surveyed we did a census of every graduate 5 years after course completion. And we can look then, for example, at what industry they're working in. We've had for many years something called the Graduate Destination Survey, which looks 6 months out. But what it would tell us is that humanities graduates are working in retail. 10% of them are working in retail, whereas in fact by year five, that's gone down to about 1% or 2%. So we need to start having new perspectives on how graduates develop their professional capability, and this was just one of them. It also gave us an insight, for example, that there's a massive and growing disparity between male and female salaries, and this is adjusted for all sorts of things like field of education and other parameters which might make a difference to that. That's of concern. And unless we get this kind of data, use it to judge how universities are going according to points of reference, then we're not going to be able to make an informed decision about the standards that are being achieved. We do have a lot of standardised tests. I completely agree with Alan. You wouldn't want one test being used by every university in the country. But what me and my colleagues at ACR find is there's a whole range of tests that are used by a whole range of universities, often in specific areas of the university, and it does provide very useful data. By no means would you want to do the same test with everyone. We have survey instruments for students, and not to leave leaders out of it, we've developed an assessment to look at leadership effectiveness, which has been developed through money from the Australian Learning and Teaching Council, and it allows leaders to look at how effective they're being in their leaders, and we're currently testing this out in vocational contexts as we speak. Once one has the data, they need to report it. I think this is an area where Australia has really done quite badly compared with other countries in the last few years. Alan referred to his very positive and affirmative ALQA report not picking up any media. I think that's a real problem. There needs to be some link between the quality assessment and the reporting, particularly to those people who are about to make a decision as to what they should do with the rest of their lives. 16-year-old students, but increasingly other people. So we develop institutional benchmark reports. In Australia, we have the Going to University website, which will give you a list of courses, and there's a commercial version of that. In the UK, they have something that actually gives you some quality metric to do with how the course is performed according to certain data. And in the US, they've started to populate it with even more data. This is data based on the student engagement survey in the US. The one I like the best, I think they've done very well because it looks like a game of Space Invaders. What it is basically a means of putting your criteria, the student can select those criteria, and the little universities there, the little academies, will shift around. It doesn't give you a number. You can then scroll over the university and see which one it is. It's so multidimensional that it's almost informative in a way that can be useful for real life. And I think that that's something that could be picked up here. It's being rolled out across Europe as we speak. I'm not going to go into any detail on how you would use that kind of data that you've reported for continuous improvement or a regulatory response. What I've done is just move around that cycle of how we can think about what counts, how we would define it, measure it, report it, and do something about it. There's lots to be done, but I think probably the first thing that could be done is to actually put someone in charge within every university of student assessment. Every university now has a surveys office. It doesn't have a student assessment office. I think that's something that should be done as a point of reference, and I may just quickly pause that up there and then turn us over to questions.
Thank you. As promised, we have some time for questions. Can I again remind you that when asking a question, if you can tell us who you are and either where you're from or what you do, I'll open the floor to questions. Now, I did give you notice beforehand. Please.
Connor King.
Yes, it is a question, Richard. Directed probably mainly at Alan, but Hamish. Connor King. I work for Philips KPA, which is an education consultancy group. I suppose a contextual question or challenge for this. I can agree or appreciate what you're saying about how you should do this. But if you're coming out of an external perspective outside universities, you're just in schools, you know, everyone does those tests, as Hamish pointed out. And we know that in year 12, we go to this enormous effort to force a common curriculum or a common outcome and measure so we can then line them up. And universities are a key beneficiary of that lining up, and probably you could say are key people forcing that to happen. And then yet, you don't like the idea of someone saying, do that at the end of university. So my question is, why not? And can you not see that from an external perspective, it looks like that ought to be the same, or perhaps are we also doing things to schools we shouldn't? So perhaps you want to talk about the consistency there.
Well, thanks, Connor. Let me start by saying something about my views about Year 12. That Year 12, I'm very keen that students should stay at school even if they're not intending to go to university. And therefore, I've been an advocate in Western Australia of developing some alternatives to TER in Year 12 to make Year 12 not dominated by those kids who are wanting to go to university. So when we select people to go to university, we need to have some measure of being able to select. How do we decide which of the large number? Now, clearly we could do it better if we had more resource and we engaged with a portfolio approach or an interview for everybody. But I think it's actually a bit different for the TER. The TER is the tertiary entrance ranking in Western Australia, I think it's called ENTER here, is a means of being able to select which students we're going to admit into which programs. And it's not perfect, but it's not a bad predictor of performance at university. So we would use whatever test to select for performance at university that gave us the best prediction. We've done a lot of work with TER in Western Australia. We've actually done some work with Monash students, and we got exactly the same result, which is that students from a government school with a TER of 85 do about as well as in weighted average mark as students from a private school with a TER of 90. But that's true on average, but it's not true for each individual student, so you can't use it to select. Now, when you come to talking about universities, at the end of a very wide range of degrees that you've done, you're saying we should have an exit exam that is equivalent to the TER. I don't know how you design such an exit exam equivalent to the TER, and you might have some ideas, but I find it pretty hard. And I was a great supporter of the graduate skills assessment and that Hamish's ACR developed, and I would have liked to have seen that administered to all students when they graduated. but it costs quite a lot of money to do, and employers put very little weight on that on those graduate schools assessment. And we actually did it for several years at the University of Western Australia, paying for it from internally, and we stopped because we couldn't get students to do it because the employers didn't value it. So that's a little bit of the thinking on that.
Hamish, a question. I'm a little puzzled by the showing of the gender wealth gap, which, after all, I thought we all knew about, and today is supposed to be, I think, a celebration of Equal Pay Day, which is a big joke. But I can't understand how that diagram, which shows indeed that women graduates start at a less pay rate than male graduates, is connected to the quality of the standards of university. You're not suggesting, are you, that women emerge with a lower standard of quality than male graduates?
I'll broaden my response beyond the gender reference. I put the graph in there because I think it really shows the sort of thinking that we can have once we start to look at outcomes, and I think that growing disparity... Well, we certainly had no national picture on that. We might have known it intuitively. We certainly had no national data around which to have the conversation before we collected it. So to me, it just really personifies the power of collecting data about what our impressive graduates are up to. I actually think in terms of, I take your point, in terms of quality, I don't think salary is at all a good measure. And in fact, I've been involved in several committees over the years that have argued just that point. And in fact, I've never seen salary being used as a measure of university quality. However, it kind of is in some contexts. I think we're sitting in an institution that would pride itself on having graduates that earn very good salaries afterwards. So it goes to that very vexed point of how we link the formal conceptual notions of salary, how we can do something practically about it, and what's actually going on in the community. So I take your point. There's a lot of muddle there, and I think we should find our way through it.
Richard James from the University of Melbourne and Director of the Centre for the Study of Higher Education. Alan, I empathise with your problems with the press because at the University of Melbourne we have some of our own problems with the press in the City of Melbourne, particularly in the last week. But my question is really to do with the awkward discussion paper. And like Hamish, I was involved in thinking it through, to use his delightful euphemism for co-authoring it. I'm a little bit dismayed that many people in the sector seem to believe that the paper suggests that we should have exit testing. In fact, the paper doesn't suggest that at all. I think the paper makes two important contributions. Yeah. One is the suggestion that we should treat students' learning outcomes as the bedrock of standards.
Yes.
And the second point that it makes that's important is that it's really disciplinary communities... Yeah. rather than individual institutions that should take up that challenge.
Yeah.
So I guess this is more a comment than a question, but I'd be interested in your view on whether or not academic achievement, as measured in what students know and can do, is the bedrock for standards, or should we be looking elsewhere?
No. Well, Richard, I'd agree with you. It's what students are capable of doing when they finish their degree, which is what, you know, which is what you're talking about, is academic achievement is the bedrock. And I agree with the paper, and I agree with you, that it is discipline specific. And so this is really not an area of disagreement, and that I don't think I did say about exit testing, but that is one way of actually going. This is how the school system, as Connor has said, validates the standard, or validates what's gone on is the student outcome in scoring a TR. But we all know the TR has got a very big socioeconomic and school context in terms of its relationship to innate ability, so that there's a whole lot of social factors that affect what the outcome is, or what the outcome is in terms of student learning. And this is one of the challenges that we've got to try and address within a university system. This is why I would prefer to use an external examiner system on the final year units to make certain that people, and that would be discipline specific, and it would be relating to learning outcomes. But it's a softer, lighter touch way than developing national, I think it was called in the paper, national discipline benchmarks, which, you know, would be a very difficult thing to do across Australia.
Margaret Mazzolini, Swinburne. I'm interested in, this is working, but I'll yell anyhow. I'm interested in teasing out whether we've really got a difference here. Hamish has talked about a whole lot of indicators and measures across a whole spectrum of things that we need to monitor at universities, student engagement, success, these factors. When we get into the exit standards issue, we're also talking about whether the pilots at my university studying aviation can land the plane, or whether the medical students here at Melbourne can actually do the operation. So we're then moving into discipline expertise and skills. I don't think those two discussions are inconsistent, but I'm interested in Hamish's comment on whether the suggestion of external examiners doesn't meet his standards in terms of looking at exit standards in terms of discipline expertise. Do you have a problem with that, Hamish? Can it be a part of a component of the whole suite that you're talking about there, or are they actually opposed?
Oh, no, I think the external examiner system that's already being seriously considered, if not run, by several universities in this country, I'm not sure how public it is, so I won't say which ones, is a very important development. I think we wouldn't want to set up a huge new building in the downtown area that just had paper shuffling through it. But if we look at systems that have been set up that are really sophisticated, think about the IB, the International Baccalaureate organisation. They have a very sophisticated system that does involve shunting PDFs of students' work around the world to all sorts of complex processes. And I think that's a wonderful system. In fact, it's pretty hard to beat in terms of a process. Very complex, and I think it would meet many of the requirements that are required to be met in terms of testifying that a student has achieved competence in a specific area. What I was trying to do by leafing through those other results is to say it's a pretty complex area as well, and we need to think about graduate capability not just in terms of academic achievement, but in terms of, as Ellen was saying, are they well formed in terms of their social skills and emotional capabilities, as we might think that a university graduate should be, and we're going to have to come at that in all sorts of ways, some of which will be idiosyncratic to particular institutions, undoubtedly.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something about data. You know, I'm very data-driven. I believe in data-based decision-making, and our university has an operational priorities plan, and every one of the priority has a set of key performance indicators. I report to my governing body every meeting of the governing body against a set of performance indicators. My salary depends on how well the university achieves against those performance indicators. That's so, you know, we are a very data rich and use a lot of data, and that's why, as Hamish said, we were very early into Aussie. In fact, we were into Aussie when it was NESI, which was, and we had to do it out of the United States, and we learnt a lot out of it. You know, the very worrying thing that shows on that data that Hamish shows, that also showed in our data, is that our students don't think they spend enough time with the staff, and they think that feedback from staff is very limited, and we're miles worse in that category than the North American universities. And of course, we have very much wider student-staff ratios than what there is in North America. And so it's perhaps not surprising that our staff haven't got enough time to provide as much feedback as what the North Americans can provide.
Richard Clifford from Box Hill Institute. Question for Hamish. I mean, we're talking about Australian tertiary education. You've been working both with the vocational education training as well as the universities, but many of the responses we've heard this evening have been separating the two. Where do you see it coming together for an organisation like TEQSA to actually be able to be successful? Are we going to have competency-based universities?
Well, there's a whole range of responses one could give to that. I'm going to stay away from most of them. And to give UG credit, you spend a lot more time working across the sectors than I have. And I value your insights as a response as well. But I think at the heart of it, if we start to focus on students or trainees or whatever, apprentices, keep in mind that the highest qualification in the university is, in fact, a training course, PhD, then we are going to look at what students are learning, how they're learning, and what they're achieving. And I think that's, as I said, that goes from 2 years old in the sandpit, can you learn how to build the castle well, to can you learn how to build it off the coast of Dubai. So it's a matter of looking at the educational fundamentals. And as that starts to happen, we start to see a lot more synergies across all aspects of learning. And, of course, learning into the workplace. That's probably how I'd come at a synergy between what is this dichotomy that's evolved in Australia and indeed varies over the decades in any case.
Jennifer Oriel, Manager of Student Access and Equity at Deakin University. Professor Robson, you mentioned a shift that was, as I recall, a Group of Eight position, I think you said, but correct me if I'm wrong, from access of lower CS students to more entry standards for them. And I'm wondering...
It's not a Group of Eight position, it's my position.
Okay, your position then, that's just as good for the question. Can you tell me, one of the things we notice, and we don't know why at this stage, is that when we get a critical mass of low SES students in an institution, it tends to affect the overall standard of those students' exit performances. So can you tell me whether you've noticed, or Hamish, in research that you've looked at, whether there is a critical mass effect once a high proportion of low SES students are enrolled in a university? And what elite universities or Group of Eight or Ivy Leagues might consider doing in the new sector and the new sector conditions in Australia to respond to that and to address those standards in your vision?
Okay, I'm happy to talk about my own university. We are right down near the bottom of low socioeconomic status, and we're right up near the top in terms of the TR that we select. So we have a major problem in getting low socioeconomic status students into our university, because to displace someone else who's got a high score with someone who's got a low score on the basis of their disadvantage is a difficult issue. So what we've done is we offer one place to every school in Western Australia to the best student in that school, provided they've got a TR over 80, which is our minimum entrance score. And we're going to change that, and at the low socioeconomic status schools, we're going to offer three places. Now, when you talk about equity, it's not just getting them into the university. We've had 19 schools that have sent someone to study law at our place who have never had anyone studying law at the University of Western Australia, because you don't get these children getting TR scores up to 98. And it's very hard. And before the load restrictions were taken off, we took these students above load and we paid for them internally rather than displace another student, because this is the other part of the equity argument. Now, we're starting a very big school intervention program called Aspire UWA with, I think, 20-odd schools in the Pilbara in the northwest, where very low levels of high SES students come, and in outer metropolitan Perth, and we are trying to address how we might lift aspirations and achievements. Now, I chaired for University Australia, the steering group that Richard did the work on equity and access. What it showed is, and this is, I think is a really big problem, is that in regional and remote, it's not just aspiration and achievement, it's actually money. And, you know, this is an issue if we're going to really address the getting low socioeconomic status students from rural and remote regions into universities, we're going to have to provide funding for them when they have to relocate. And, you know, OK, we've addressed the student support mechanisms. Great credit to the government for doing that, in my view, lifting the capacity. But we need to do a lot more, and we need to address aspiration and achievement within some of the other areas. So, of course, we can do things, and of course, we have to do things. It's unacceptable that so many parts of the university is not available. Now, with Indigenous students, we offer bridging programs to get them into law and medicine. And I think we will have trained more Indigenous doctors than any other university in Australia, and I regard that as being very, very significant achievement in terms of changing and setting up role models and changing the sort of ideas about low socioeconomic status.
Only just to say I'm not aware of any work in the public domain that links academic standards or achievement with equity groups.
I doubt it. You know, we've got low numbers, but our attrition rate of low socioeconomic students is the third lowest in Australia and is very similar to our attrition rate for non-SES students. So the SES students that get into our university, we have pretty smart students. They come from the high socioeconomic status, but they're still able to somehow access Centrelink.
I was thinking about US systems.
I will actually add that in the Graduate Pathways Survey, we tried a whole new ways of measuring equity that we haven't done so far in Australia, like parental education, occupation, all sorts of family background, where you went to primary school. Often families will move to Parkville to go to Melbourne University, for example. So it's a primary school locality that counts, and we found absolutely no difference in graduation. So to the extent that they start from a lower base or they start in a disadvantaged position, they catch up. And that's in fact, the evidence that I am aware of, and it's fairly positive. So, yeah. No, the US is, of course, completely.
Maybe two more questions. I've got one here.
Mayor was Bolan, and I work for both La Trobe University as well as Northern Melbourne Institute of TAFE. And a question perhaps to Alan Robson. I fully agree that we have a very high quality university system, and I'm also very fully aware of all the quality audits and all the reporting we have to do. And I seem to understand that you suggest that the university sector ought to take responsibility themselves and become a bit more self-regulating. And the question I have is how do you become part of that club, and how you're being thrown out of it, and who would do that sort of activity?
Well, I think the question you raise is a very important issue, because how do you become part? And let me say right from the start, I'm not arguing for self-regulation. I believe in ORCA and TESQA and having a quality assurance, an overall review, someone come in from outside. Practice external review. Every part of our university is reviewed at least every 5 years, including the administrative parts of the university. That's what I call part of continuous improvement. Bring people in from outside. You do an internal audit followed by... you do an external internal self-evaluation followed by an external audit. Now, how do places become universities? And is a very... And how are we going to meet the 40% of graduates, of people who are going to be graduates? Now, I have a view we will need to develop some new types of institutions. You go to California. In California, where I think a bit over 35% of the age cohort have degrees, 66% of the students are in community colleges, 22% are in the Cal State system, and 11% are in the University of California system. So I think, you know, there's going to be a need in Australia to develop a high-quality community college or high-quality liberal arts or high-quality polytechnics, whatever we want to call them. And we've got to try and develop the same parity of esteem. This is what I like about the United States system. A good liberal arts college is regarded just as highly as a good research university. And a good community college is also very highly regarded. We don't seem to be able to have that, and it leads to everyone aspiring to be a particular type of institution which isn't meeting the needs of the entire range of people in our community. And that, I think, is a challenge if we're going to get to 40% of the age cohort holding a bachelor's degree. And I think that would be good for Australia.
Thanking and appreciating Professor Robson. You can see there's one more roll before we close the evening, and I'm just to follow the pattern. I'm Shield Rickards. I'm Dean of the Graduate School of Education, and that is home of both the Centre for the Study of Higher Education, the L.H. Martin Institute. It's highly appropriate that I also add my thanks to the two speakers and indeed Stephen Weller, who's done an outstanding job as chair. Alan Robson and Hamish Coates, I think, have really given two really high quality presentations, quite stimulating and thought provoking. I really thank them not only for their presentations, but these occasions require a lot of preparation, a lot of time. And like many people here, they're extremely busy in the roles that they have. So I thank them for that, and you can see that for each of the three of them, a small token. I don't know what vintage, I don't know what colour, but I'm sure it's high quality. There are some other people that I'd like to thank. I'd like to thank Richard James, who's director of the Centre for the Study of Higher Education, Lynn Meek, who directs the Martin Institute, Michelle Siegel, who puts these evenings together, and the other people who make these wonderful series. This is the third of this year's series, which follows on from the first series last year, which I think had five occasions, which leads me then to thank Connor King, who I think's been to everyone and each time asks the first question. So I don't know if we pay you, Connor, for that, but it's really good for you to break the ice each time. But finally, I thank you as an audience. Without you coming and supporting and showing your interest, these evenings wouldn't go very well at all. So I thank you. Please join me in thanking our speakers.